I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge from WNIJ. And if this is your first time hearing our show, good news. It's a really simple idea. We've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we have on this podcast, whether a teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by the people who listen. We want you to be a part of this show. So please do tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations and your story ideas at teacherslounge@niu.edu. This week, it's our conversation with Northern Illinois University Distinguished Teaching Professor, Dr. Gulsat Aygin. Gulsat is a world-renowned linguistics teacher, author, and translator. She has had an absolutely remarkable life, from growing up in Turkey, spending time as a political prisoner, to coming to the United States to study at Harvard, and now teaching at NIU. And we had a long, wonderful conversation about her life and the ultimate goal of education. So we're presenting it to you in two parts so we can make sure to bring you as much as possible. And we start off by talking about her experience teaching English as a non-native speaker. Without any further ado, Dr. Gulsat Aygin.
At Harvard and MIT, the classroom consisted of mostly non-native speakers. There would always be one, maybe one native speaker of English. Sometimes even the professors would be non-native speakers. So while we needed some native speaker judgment, we would look around. And I do remember at times when I opened the door and asked, you know, is there a native speaker? We want your judgment. We do have a different perspective, of course, because we do not think as a non-native speaker of English, which is an Indo-European language, I do not have the mind of a Eurocentric approach to any science, literature, or worldview. So we have different perspectives into these things, but I'm heavily educated in the Western tradition, starting with junior high in an American high school in Turkey, and then continued to attend institutions founded by Americans in Turkey, then America. So I'm well-versed in the culture. Sure. In that sense. But you're right, I do bring in a new perspective and moreover interesting experiences. I think it serves in two ways. I had many interesting experiences, anecdotes I could share, and I do share with my students at NIU or other institutions, at Harvard too, because I taught at Harvard and I sometimes do teach there as well in summer programs. And I did have students rioting in my classroom the first time I was teaching linguistics class and complaining to my chair, saying that their parents are not paying $100,000 to learn about language and English from a non-native speaker.
So they were rioting because you were a non-native speaker?
Exactly. So my chair called me to his office. I was so amazed and so scared. I had just gotten my degree. And he said, what am I going to do now? He said, no, this is your course. We have certified you as an expert, so you're going to go back to that classroom and teach. But he said, I have reminded them of the something in the original charter of Harvard, where families, parents can come and evaluate the quality of education in the classroom, which was included in the charter in the 1600s, of course, because it was a small school with 20 students and two teachers. But so he said, I invited them, and just remember that some of their parents will be Harvard graduated and they'll do their homework. So I had that experience. They did come. It was a very interesting experience, but the very same class nominated me, and I got the award as one of the teaching excellence in teaching awards at Harvard, thanks to that class. So I had that kind of an experience at NIU. I had a group of students in this very class I'm talking about rebel as a group and actually insult me verbally in the classroom, asking me what the blip I was doing trying to teach them their own language, which I turned into a teaching moment. And I got great reviews from that class as well, including those students, because I present myself as a product of good education. And I said, yeah. Hey, what? If I can do this as a non-native speaker, so I try to play the role of a role model, I should say. I try to become a role model for them, to inspire them to do better on the contrary. But it has not been easy. I'm not going to say it was easy. It is easy. But when you know what you're doing, it doesn't hurt you or break your heart much.
Well, and talking about your teaching style, one of the things, again, that the person who nominated you mentioned, and I had seen this written about you as well, is that some of the students that you love teaching the most are the people who don't come in necessarily with a substantial interest in linguistics, or might be towards the back of the class, might be dozing off a little bit, maybe have their hoods over their heads.
Exactly. That is true. That is a fact. First of all, I like being challenged. You know, I could never do this type of teaching, walking into the classroom, doing the same things again and again and again, knowing that I've done my job and leaving. Because first of all, I don't believe in teaching. I believe in learning. And I see myself as a fellow learner. So I share my experience in learning with the students. So I don't like that hierarchy either, and we can talk about it at more length from an educational philosophy point of view as well. And I do like such students because they challenge me. And I challenge them, you know, when I walk into the classroom, now I'm teaching online, but it works the same way. I have found new ways to adopt my style in the online forum. When I walked into the classrooms, I would be like a rock star. I mean, I'm not talented. I can't sing, don't get me wrong. It's just a metaphor, a simile, I should say. So I would be jumping up and down, walking, addressing each one of them. And I always start my classes with music, invigorating music, my choice first, and then invite them to share their favorite music with me. And I tell anecdotes, I bring myself into the classroom, I share personal information, which wakes everybody up. Because there are certain things that students react to. I used to be a little more radical before I came to NIU, but because I did teach at Reed College, where I was free to do a lot more, like throwing golf balls to the students while talking, because it actually activates the left brain and makes learning more efficient according to some neurological studies. But I was warned against it by my colleagues because of liability issues.
So, yeah, maybe a squishier ball, maybe you could get away with that.
Still, they didn't let me do it.
And sure.
And so I do challenge them to sleep. I say, do sleep. If your eyelids are down, it is my fault, not yours. And or your choice. Maybe I'm doing all I can. And if you're still not interested, it is your choice. Because I do believe in learning when you want to. Learning happens, one, when you have a question in mind. Two, when you really want to. This is not the platform we're inviting our students to, because we present education as a means to an end that brings money and livelihood in life. So that's not how I want to operate. That's not how I learned myself. I had a student once saying, I'm not going to come to class anymore from now on. I'm going to take off points. I said, if you tell me, if you justify your choice as an adult, I'm not. And she told me, she's making a lot of money working with somebody, you know, starting her own business. And why am I supposed to learn all this? I said, I can answer that question if we can meet sometime when you have the time. If not, this is your choice. Be my guest. But if you don't take the exams, you're going to fail. I mean, that's inevitable.
Yeah.
And then that student became one of my, favorite students, in the sense that they did skip their, you know, own work to come to class. Because here's what I cannot make them want to learn unless I share my emotions and the experiences which brought me joy in learning. So I do make that emotional connection. And secondly, I also make them think about questions and I invite them to challenge me. I give credit to students who challenge me, who challenge the material, who challenge what I argue is correct. who give an incorrect, has the courage to give an incorrect answer so that I can explain it for the benefit of the rest of the class. So I give extra credit for being a community member, contributing to a learning community, because a classroom is a learning community where I see the more experienced one.
Yeah, this is what we're talking about too, about breaking down the hierarchies within the classroom, is that they are bringing you things as well as you're bringing them things.
Exactly. But I mean, this all boils down to actually our nature as human beings. If you let me, I'm going to get into the more abstract side of it and tie it to my actual practices in the classroom environment. The human nature, I believe, I'm a Chomskyan linguist, and I'm proud to call him my mentor, professor, and friend. And I am convinced about his approach to what human nature is and how learning happens. And he's not the only guide for me, because I've read extensively on the topic, and my life's experiences have taught me a lot. And I was very lucky to be born in a family where my teaching started with my learning around age 3 or 4, when I learned how to read and write, because I was asked what I learned for the purposes of learning. But you know, my father asked me when he came home, okay, what did you learn today? Maybe there's something I would like to learn too. So I thought I was teaching him at the age of 4. And he was learning, because he would be engaged in a conversation with me, asking questions, trying to get details, etc. So I had a very advantageous environment growing up. And my elder brother and sister are very scholarly oriented people too. So I had great role models as well. So I believe, and I agree with Chomsky in that, We are a unique biological organism, right, as human species. Of course, in linguistics, we are aware of it, because language, human language, is unique to our species. But there are more unique qualities to our species than language, which language enables us to do, probably. So we have unique cognitive and intellectual traits. So we are an biological organism, but we are endowed with a unique intellectual capacity to think, to reason, and to communicate. But it turns out all of these activities and creativity rely on our freedom. They're all contingent upon the freedom to do those. So freedom, creativity, and learning are actually part of our natural existence. That is why I don't think we need to do anything exceptional in terms of our learning environments created in the formal education system. If we just let them be their natural selves, be able to express what they're curious about or interested in, and if we invite them to ask questions, then they can learn. So how do I do that? In practice, I challenge them, but by saying outrageous things or seemingly outrageous things. Actually, they're real things that I'm sharing with them. I even before it became very popular, like at least a decade or 2 decades ago, I used to teach a course in language and gender. And I would walk into the classroom and say, who here is a sexist? Nobody would raise their hands, and I would. And I would say, who here is a racist? Nobody, myself. And then I would start asking questions like, you know, I had adult students, would you like your daughter to be non-binary and dating someone of the, you know, seemingly same biological sex, et cetera? And they would be furious. I would say, yeah, here you go. So I would say, would you, and they, who here is prejudiced against certain concepts? Nobody but me. And I would say, okay, at the end of the class, I'm giving you an assignment. Go home to your parents or your dorm, to your friends, and tell them you have a former death row person teaching me in my class. What do you think about it as my professor? And they were shocked. And I said it at the last moment. And I said, suppose this is the case. Well, how would they react? So they brought in all the reactions, and I told them I really was charged by the capital punishment under a coup d'etat in a military, you know, prison in a military court system in my youth because I was a social activist for social justice and freedom. So then suddenly perceptions change. So I do shock my students at times. So talking about learning, I share with them my anecdotes about learning and teaching, what I learned and what I couldn't learn or what I could teach under really extreme circumstances. You know, this Chomskyan approach to the fact that we have to provide freedom, first of all, for this innate nature of humanity to surface. So I do share, although, you know, freedom is extremely important, what freedom or what is freedom was a question in my mind, because what is humanizing for us is to flourish with these traits and qualities, creativeness, in solidarity and collectively. So how do we do that? And of course, in my previous experience as a political prisoner, I mean, how did I end up being more human than I ever was, despite all the torture and dehumanizing circumstances I was in? I always think about this, and that is part of my memoirs in works, in progress, because I understand that, because I always won, so the human nature in everyone oppressing me and trying to hurt me and address their human side, in my mind, soul, and behavior, regardless of what they were doing to me. And secondly, collectivism, solidarity with my fellow prisoners. You know, we have a published book. I have a contribution to that, where I state that what I remember solely, mostly from that experience, is the best qualities of humanity. People around me in solidarity, helping me carry out the daily tasks of taking care of my body when I couldn't, and who always, we always supported each other. So that's how we got more humanized. So I share this with my students. So now we are in a much more free environment. We need more freedom, don't get me wrong. And the struggle for more freedom against authoritarianism just continues, because it's in our nature. We can all do better in any given society, globally. So, and I share with them how much I learned teaching and in such circumstances. I was teaching English to my fellow prisoners. They put me in a cell to stop it. I did it, and, you know, or in a sort of a ward with cells. I did it by learning the Morse code, and I continued teaching with the Morse code. And when I was doing that, I recognized that teaching with the alphabet is clumsy, because there is no one-to-one correspondence with sounds, right, and letters, because English is not a phonetic language, unfortunately. So I started using sounds instead. And that, later on, I figured out was phonetics and linguistics. So I had this analytical experience under such circumstances. I was teaching dancing. I'm not a great dancer, again, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't matter. I knew some, you know, waltzes and tangos, etc., when I was there, because of my, you know, American education early on in a wonderful high school in Istanbul. So, you know, I do share such things, and I also share my impossible moments in life, the benefits of dreaming for the impossible, whether you arrive there or not, having a better life for that. And of course, I have such moments in my life that are exceptional. So in terms of the teaching philosophy, that is why, because I come from a social activism, I see parallels in the goals of activism and education. So social activism, of course, is a way to reach the goal of creating a more just, peaceful environment in the society, that kind of a society, and peace particularly, which I'm keen on. Well, the goal of education is a way to enable people who will create that society.
Give them the freedom to do that.
The freedom to do that, and also the need, remember the need to do that. As human beings, we need to be open to new ideas, we need to be able to put up with each other, and we can collaborate as such and create something better for all of us. So that overlaps, you know, there is such parallelism. That's why I walked into this area rather than working for a corporate world, because I thought I could transfer my skills here, which I did, and it seems to be fruitful. And I figured out the more we trust our students, the more they learn. So quote-unquote cheating is free in my classes because I don't see anything as cheating. I see them as learning devices. So everything is open book. I encourage them to talk to each other and work collectively. Sometimes they end up sharing the mistake, which is wonderful because there is sometimes someone with powerful voice or intellectual argumentation led them into believing something else. I credit that as well. And then we discuss it all together and question those arguments and end up somewhere else. So everything is open, everything is free, and there's more learning happening in my classes, I believe, than elsewhere. And I have to acknowledge my experience at Reed College.
Yeah.
All these approaches, because Reed College in Portland has a dramatically different system than what we have in our state university system, and even the Ivy League in most ways, I should say. So Reed College students don't see their grades. You don't grade them per se. You send the grades to the registration. And if there's anything dramatic going on, they communicate with the student on that. The faculty's communication with the student is about feedback. So I would respond to each exam with at least a page long letter, I should say. And sometimes meet with them if they wish to, or if I insist, so that the relationship between faculty and students would be an intellectual one, rather than somebody waving a red pen.
Right. It becomes more punitive that way.
Exactly. Because that is the problem with our institutional, educational system, to be honest. You know, our world is geared towards material gains, right? And behaving in out of self-interest, which are two horrible things in my world. So we should be going not for self-interest, but mutual interest to begin with. And grades are like material gains. You know, they should not be the end. They can be a means for something. So diplomas are means for better good. I mean, it shouldn't be the end. I mean, you should enjoy learning. And then at the end, somebody should give you a piece of paper saying, you know enough. That is why a lot of learning can happen out of the formal education system, for instance. A lot right. of learning. I mean, I have all the diplomas, one can imagine, but I've done most of my learning outside of institutional laws, or thanks to some exceptional instructors I've had in my life, exceptional people I have met, exceptional circumstances I have been put into were my bigger teachers. So I don't even like the term teacher. If I use it, I usually pair it with learner, because
yes.
I don't even, you know, like liberties, you know, education is like liberty. It is not given. It is taken. I'm sorry.
It comes back to something that you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation when you talking about how so much learning happens outside of these formal structures, is that you mentioned that a lot of times when we learn, it's because we have a question or because we're pursuing something more specific, not necessarily, you know, when the diploma or someone in your class is often not in your class because they have a specific question or they have a specific need to learn something about linguistics, but because it is a rung on the ladder that leads to a diploma that leads to some kind of larger paycheck that they're hoping for at the end of the day. And that is something that is, you know, I imagine you mentioned about how obviously you bring so much of yourself to your classes, to open up the conversation, open up the dialogue, and give people the freedom to ask you those questions. It's interesting specifically when, you know, you teach linguistics, and I imagine a lot of people come in to your class with the perception that linguistics is very rigid and is a set of grammar rules and things that they have to occupy, and they aren't very excited by. But opening them up to that, there was a quote that I had from one of your former colleagues who said that you provide students the opportunity to, quote, to think about linguistics and grammar in informative and life-changing ways. And I just am fascinated about this idea of linguistics and grammar being these like very, very urgent and vital and life-changing things.
Wonderful. Thank you for saying that and sharing that comment with me. I think anything, any content we teach can be turned into it. I'm lucky because I'm a linguist, because language is what connects us all and how we communicate. So yes, they always come sighing and just another boring class about language. And what am I going to learn here? What is that going to do for my life? You're so very right. First of all, I invite them to bring what they have. I always have a questionnaire, and which they can voluntarily answer or not, about what language they speak at home. I try to empower them to defend their basic human right of having all human rights, starting with speaking your native tongue and native language accent. So linguistics rights, as established in Europe at the linguistics conference, no wonder why, in 1996 in Barcelona, I have extended it to include in my research and work and to include all accents, native accents or foreign accents, as long as they're all intelligible, which they are mutually intelligible. So in my classroom, I want everyone to speak as they would speak in the dorm. I don't push them to be formal in their way they speak. And everything we're discussing, I ask their judgments to begin with, whether something sounds grammatical or ungrammatical, and then have them observe and identify what makes something ungrammatical. Because what makes something ungrammatical has to do with the universal grammar in our mind, our faculty, that Chomsky, Noam has identified, where we share major properties with the world's languages, but we pick up from a whole set certain properties and call it English or call it this or that.
And right, English is a collection of various, you know, Latin, Romance, all German, all over the place.
Yeah, from the lexicon, yes.
Yeah.
In terms of the lexicon, I mean, English has so much, you know, borrowed words.
There right.
Are over 200 Turkish words in the English lexicon.
Oh, really? Do you have a favorite?
Yeah, yogurt. Of course.
Yes.
Everybody knows that. That's why I always yeah. Example. Of course, I hate to say, because of colonialism and all related invasions and imperialism in the world, of course, there are so many variations of English all around the world. And, you know, we start in linguistics, and that's how I start my classes. What is language? Well, language is a dialect with a flag and an army. Because a language cannot be defined as all dialects are languages from a linguistic perspective. Language with a flag and an army dates back to the French Revolution, of course, the concept of nationalism, national identity, etc. So you may have different countries speaking the same language, but they call their languages with different names. Mutually intelligible languages are in abundance in the world with different flags attached to them. The former Yugoslavia is one such example, among others. So once I challenge the idea of one correct language, English, and that language is a living, thriving entity, then I invite them to claim their own variation of English to begin with, regardless of all the pressure of the standardization in the school system. And I try to, you know, invite them to study different languages. Of course, they have to deal with different languages in my linguistic classes, not only English, so that they can have a different perspective into English. So I invite them to look at English as if it's an alien object. So I tell them, I've just dropped you from a helicopter with a parachute, don't worry, into the Amazons, and you're going to have to study the languages you come across there, which we do as linguists. And I've done a lot of field work in the world. I give my anecdotes and stories from those experiences, how would you study this exotic language called English, for instance? So by distancing ourselves and bringing it as an object of study and looking at it from a scientific perspective, mimicking scientific methodology, observation of patterns, generalization over patterns, hypothesizing, then testing it on more data and redefining what we're looking at. So I call this in my research and talks and mimicking a scientific methodology in the classroom. So I sometimes end the class saying, well, are you all convinced about everything we discussed today in class about this and that? They all say yes. I say, okay, now your homework. I said one non-fact and I convinced you. Figure out what it is. Whoever figures it out gets an A. Sometimes I add it to my exams. So I want them to question me, not believe me, because we have to be open to changing our mind. As Kahneman said, you know, what is the, I want to talk about the ultimate outcome of education, if you will allow me.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that question as well, right? I mean, I think this whole conversation we've been having has been leading to what is, you know, what is the goal of education? What are we trying? Are we trying to learn just for the pursuit of knowledge? Are we doing it for practical applications? There's so many other questions, but you go ahead and finish your thought.
Okay. So what is the ultimate goal of education? You know, I always keep thinking about it as someone who has done a lot of informal learning as well as formal. I mean, the formal learnings were for because I wanted to see what else could challenge me and what else is out there that I cannot reach. And what is academia all about? Why is it the center of intellectual production, which it not always is? Sometimes the center of intellectual world is outside of academia. So that is what led me, kept leading me back to academia and the bigger question in my mind. And interestingly, the answers that I thought I found were, of course, thought about by other people too. So I want to refer to them a bit, if you will allow me. There was a Gallup survey poll done in 2012, probably, but I may not be remembering the date correctly. They asked 32 higher education leaders, you know, presidents of universities, etc., what the ultimate goal of education is. Almost all of them, except one, answered it by saying, "Our graduates to have thriving lives and engaging careers." And then it turns out no institution actually follows up with this outcome. Nobody measures it. So there is no way any institution is following up with their graduates in 10 years, 20 years and asking these questions. Sometimes Harvard sends me some survey saying, "Are you happy with what you make?" And which I answer no every time. But, you know, what is that? You know, that's not really the essence of education. Why am I even getting that question, right? So to that survey, one person, and not surprisingly, one of my favorite people whose work I keep reading, Danielle Kahneman, the 2002 Nobel Prize winner, who is at Princeton still, I believe, he said, well, simple. It is to change what you believe. Perfect. I used to say what you believe you know, which basically is what he claims. So change what you believe. That is the purpose. And I do, you know, in my what I call learner training sessions at the beginning of each semester, I bring these topics like, why are we here? Why am I here? What are we doing in this world, etc. You know, very ontological and existential questions. And yes, we are here to change what we believe, not only students, but us too. That's why I'm in academia. I'm still doing research and I'm falsifying my previous work at times, which I should be. If you don't, you're not on the right track. So changing what you believe in is crucial, not changing what you know, because knowledge is about facts, you know, scientific methodology, remember, which can, even that knowledge can be changed, because in time we recognize mistakes and rephrase and rework on those. This is the history of humanity. What we belief is an emotion. So belief system is based on what is absolutely assumed to be absolutely true. That's where we fall apart as a society, in educational system. Students perceive what we say as absolute truth that needs to be reiterated. A lot of us believe we really know what we're talking about. I don't. And I always confront it because there is no absolute truth, for God's sake. If there is one, it should be God. And, you know, we can only figure that out in heaven if we end up there and if there is one. So depending on where you stand in these belief systems. But somehow, while we talk about facts these days, it has become facts. There is no absolute fact. I mean, there is statistical numbers. Even statistics is not a science, you know. Numbers, polls, what have you. They don't tell us much until you start questioning what you have been assuming, what these questions embed as presuppositions. So in my classes, again, I'm going to connect it to my classes. Since this is the actual outcome, I need to change what they believe. And I can only do it by showing that I challenge my own beliefs about what I know. I either share my experiences of changing my mind, or I invite them to change my mind. And you know what? They sometimes do. So in terms of what students can bring to the classroom, their unique perspectives. I keep learning from my students, and I do let them know what I have learned from them, so that there is a true communication going on. Now, we, the learned, educated people, are not aware of something. Books are material objects which provides no distance between the text and the reader, and as such equalizes all readers to a certain extent, right? So there's no distance among us when we're reading the same book. So that's why we fetishize books and written word, which is our creation, by the way. Writing systems are our creation. It's not part of our nature. Language as we speak and sign it is in our nature. Anyways, that is the linguistic argument to it. So when we communicate in a classroom environment, in any environment you can think of, there is a distance between our minds that we need to bridge. So bridge means distance. But I have more faith in human communication than most people do because of this emotional connection we can create. Belief is about emotions. Well, guess what? So is knowledge. You know, if we argue on a topic with genuine, authentic intentions of communication, and if we can listen to ourselves and catch our own presuppositions in our communication, the communication quality raises. And in our classrooms, I try to do that elsewhere too. We should be doing it, and I preach it in many talks. All questions are presuppositional. So when you say, have you done this? You assume yes or no, or there is no none of the above in that sense. There are two options, whereas there should be. Because there's something embedded in the sentence, a presupposition. Did you break the vase? Means the vase is broken. So you say yes or no, if you're caught off guard. But the real reaction is to make sure the vase is broken before answering the question, because you may have done it, you know, without accidentally. So you have to start by checking the facts of each and every innocent question. So, which brings us to the second component of the outcomes of learning outcomes. One, changing what you believe, being open to other ideas and questioning yourself, which will create more bridges and more communication in our society. And the second one is questioning all presuppositions, not answering any question immediately, thinking about it. I always say, if somebody gives you options, would you like to do this, that, or that? What should your immediate thought be in your mind? So somebody says, whichever one I like and whichever serves my interest. And so I say, no. The first thing you should think is none of the above. Why are they asking me this question? Why are these three the only options? Maybe there are other options that you want, right? You're limited with the options. Hence the multiple choice exams disaster in our world that we have to apply. So because of my I'll tie this into this critical thinking issue, into how freedom actually allows true learning, true critical thinking skills to flourish. So our job in education is actually to cultivate growth. I mean, teaching methods, this and that, constitute only 10, 20% of it, probably. 80% of it is recognizing our students as individuals, cultivating their growth through getting them to be interested in learning. So I see my job primarily to make sure they're convinced that it is worth learning. So I teach this grammar class, which is supposed to be boring. So I tell them, the best you're going to get out of this class, on your deathbed, which I will be dead by now, if you remember this class, it's not going to be the content. It is going to be what you felt in this class and how it inspired you to keep learning in your life. Basically, the new neuropaths you have created in this class. So I have a medical background, so I usually use metaphors accordingly, or the physical reality of medicine in terms of neurocognition. So I say, okay, what is a noun? I don't want anyone to answer. Or I start with, what is a bird? So they come to class, I'm asking them what a bird is. So I say, this is our main task. What is a bird? Defined. Give me three qualities, or the main quality of a bird that distinguishes it from other animals. So of course they come up with wings, right? Wings. So animals with wings are birds. Of course I show a bee, I show something that has a wing, anything you can come up with. Is this a bird? No, it's not. So somebody says beak. Then I show animals with beaks, etc. So then beak, wing, this and that. And then it turns out the feet matter a lot. So when we're doing all of those, trying to identify, so I make them generalize and hypothesize, for which I have a guideline, of course. I say, look at the form, look at the location. Let's look at the form, what it looks like. Let's look at the location, where it lands or where that form appears. What does it do? And then, form, location, function. What are the functions of those? How do you distinguish predator birds from, regular birds or chickens kind of stories? So form, location, function. So there's a system at work. The method is you observe, you generalize, you test it with more data. And then I come into saying, I'm going to ask you a very boring question. You will not answer me as the name of a thing or a person or blah, blah. What is a noun? They have no answer to that question, right? If I forbid them from using the casual, the traditional definition, because I say, enthusiasm, is this a thing? No. Animal? No. Person? No. Thing, what is it? So obviously, or maybe I can give you a word like blubluk. What does it mean? You don't know the meaning of it. Of course, it doesn't exist in English, but it does exist in some other language. If you don't know the meaning, you won't know what type of word it is. How are you going to discover that when I drop you off in the Amazon trying to figure out the language? How do we do it as field linguists? Of course, we'll look at these in the sentence. Where is it sitting? What kind of a tag it takes, etc. So that then we go into this. And I ask them, when I ask you a question, I have to give a quiz or something. I don't want you to answer with your gut instinct. Consider your gut instinct, your hypothesis. Rationalize it. Then provide evidence, syntactic evidence, morphological evidence, then give your answer. So in my classes, we just focus on these, and I give extra credit to anyone not giving the correct answer, but giving the right reasoning. And sometimes the student gives an incorrect answer that I would not be expecting, but has an excellent reasoning. I give extra credit, and I invite them to come up with ways. I ask them how they remember certain things. They come up with acronyms, very funny things, hilarious stuff. I joined them at their gaming platform. I don't play video games, but the new generation does, right? So I hold office hours on a gaming platform. I learn a lot from them. And then, sometimes I send my TA to the gaming platform to invite them to class. There's more fun happening here, you're missing it type of things. So back to the original question, they're all tie in, as you see, the outcome of education, human nature, what knowledge really is, And what it is our job to do in our educational institutions. So empowering students, and these are all buzzwords, but how do you empower somebody? By getting rid of your authority. Again, one of the authors that I adore, a Nobel Prize winner in literature, Elia Canetti, Krausen Power, which I translated into Turkish decades ago, a masterpiece, as I said, where he claims anyone can be a bad person. Anyone is capable of being Hitler, for God's sake. We are born with this curiosity and creativity, and that creativity can turn into a destructive one, one might argue. But I do find that even so, that can be overcome by creativity as well, and prevented by creativity. So it's a humanizing process. You know, we are born into the species with all this capacity. What we don't become human at some point. Becoming a human is a lifelong process. At my deathbed, I hope I will say, well, I have become as human as possible. That would be my biggest achievement. And that is what I advocate for. I'm not going to say, oh, thank God I aced that exam when I was in college. My students, nobody will remember anything such that. But the humanizing process, using our natural qualities to become more human, meaning sharing the same values we all obviously are, you know, across cultures, all religions actually share the same values regarding vice and virtue. Everybody claims to do what they're doing on behalf of community, even the people who are doing horrible things. You know, my torturers were thinking they were serving their country because I was a traitor in their eyes, which I was not, obviously. So a lot of violence is justified with the same idea, because every human being wants to do something good, but we don't agree on what is good, and we are easily swayed off with what ideological systems impose on us as good practices. So we have, thanks to Canetti as well, so many decades ago, I have recognized that my whole life I have been dedicated to becoming more human, thanks to some values I had from my family and education and experiences. And becoming more human is not easy, because you have to keep second guessing yourself, questioning your beliefs all the time. It is so convenient to believe in something. You know, I've been saying, you know, Chomsky, I agree with Chomsky on this, Chomsky on that. I really love him and admire and respect him. And I believe he does respect me, because I have disagreed with him many times. My dissertation was based on a disagreement on case and agreement, decoupling them. So a disagreement should not shed away our human connection, because we have to remember that becoming more human requires self-doubt, self-questioning, questioning everything. And it's tiring and exhausting. How do you find the energy for that? So sometimes my students ask me that, because I end up my semester talking about things about my life to empower them. And how do you find the energy? You know, it's too difficult. It is too difficult. I can explain why I find it. I'm at a good point in my life, because I have so much positive input. Here I am talking to you. You know, my students and people have found me valuable enough to nominate me to participate in your program. I mean, this is awesome. This is great, great support system. And this is an indication of solidarity. And I do receive emails from my students I taught long ago that empower me. One of them wrote to me saying, I was this, you know, chauvinistic, heterosexual bigot in your class. This is the language she used. I'm not using, making it up. And, you know, after taking your language and gender, I got married. I have two daughters, one of whom is non-binary. And I'm so happy and proud to be the parents of my daughters. And I want to acknowledge your contribution to that. I mean, what could be better? I don't want a Nobel Prize.
Yeah, he didn't email you to say, I just wanted to remind you that I still remember I passed that test.
Nobody does that.
Nobody does that.
Remember. Why should they? They shouldn't. That's why I don't want them to be happy about their A's, because I say then you're going to be unhappy about your F's. So let's cheat the system. Don't attach any emotions to grading. So that's why I give them the opportunity to open books and, you know, learn everything as much as they can, cheating if they want. It's not cheating, it's learning in a different way. So where do you find this energy? I find it from this, of course. My students are great. You know, I wake up in the morning sometimes, you know, not feeling up to it because of the status quo in the world with all the wars and violence and what have you, poverty, racism, sexism, you say it, name it. But I have my students. I owe it to them. And of course, I owe it to everyone in this becoming, I have to become the best human I can ever be. This is my true mission for many people. I owe it to many people who never had the opportunities I did, who never ended up doing a job they love, who actually suffered at least as much as I have, but more. Some lost their lives defending the rights for humanity, struggling for it, for peace, freedom of speech. Generations who suffered and people who died for their values all around the world, or those who did not die, who went through what I went through, but could not keep their joy of life to continue the fight, and they have lost their hope. I owe it to everyone hopeless on earth to continue to be optimistic, to continue to become more human every day, try to be more human. Try to be ready to change my beliefs. Try not to react emotionally to people who do not think like me, because that is what I saved me in my previous experience. You know, I people have wrote things about me. There's this book, Jerry Labor, spared a chapter to me. I salute her here. She's one of the Helsinki Watch leaders who actually saved me from prison in Turkey, along with someone in my family, my sister, who advocated for me in America, and a lot of Americans who wrote on my behalf to save my life. I owe it to all these wonderful values and people carrying those values in the world. You know, she wrote a book on courage of others based on her human rights experience. And she tells that anecdote there because one of my torturers had a stomach pain, severe one, when he was torturing me. It went down for a few days. I was a medical student, remember? So I recommended him some pills and some diet while he was torturing me. And the very same man actually cried for me at some point when I couldn't move. And, you know, those tears healed me. Just seeing him as a human being, this regardless of everything, I empathize with them because nobody should be doing those things to earn a living. Nobody should be killing other people for any reason other than defending themselves. Maybe even that is, and I'm a pacifist in that sense, but not an absolute one. So I owe it to everyone who fought, who lost so much, who lost their loved ones, who mostly hopes. And today in our society and globally, the major problem is, you know, people have lost their hopes in systems, in nature of humanity. So I want to be the voice, at least in my classes. And I benefit from this too. I have to remain and keep becoming a better human being with all the relevant values for everyone on earth, every living thing on earth, including cats, of course. My dear cats, one of whom I had just locked out, but he's serving humanity in this, my, you know, this speech in a sense, indirectly. I owe it to everyone who doesn't have any hope left, sitting in their homes, desperate for actualizing their own capabilities, creativity, but not being able to exercise them for various reasons, including all kinds of oppression and, you know, discrimination. Or because just absorbing the world in its worst phase, probably. I invite everyone to, in my classes as well, to keep their faith in humanity, starting with themselves. And that's what I'm doing. This is where I find my energy. As long as I exist, you exist, who cares? As long as my students exist, as long as my colleagues and all the wonderful people in the world exist, and my colleagues at NIU are really exceptional in this sense, I'm very lucky. As long as we exist, hope exists.
Thank you for all that. One of the things I wanted to mention that you talked about there is this idea that opening up freedom in your classroom for your students involves taking some of that power and authority away from you. And that's something that, obviously, in education, I'm sure people have a hard time with when they are teachers, that they feel like they've worked, they've, you know, achieved that degree in teaching. They have, you know, they're older than their students. All of these number of things that they feel like have earned them this authority that it can be difficult to cede to join your students in the learning. It's something I think about as well as a journalist, right? Like, as a journalist, there's an implication of some kind of authority or greater knowledge than I have, which I don't. I'm trying my best over here, but, you know, it's as simple as that. But that is such a difficult thing. I'm curious, again, since I know a lot of teachers listen to this show as well, of how to go about that process for anyone, not just teachers, of opening yourself up, ceding some of that perceived power and authority to join other people in conversation and then that larger freedom.
It is not easy, I believe. It is easier. It has been easier for me because I never believed in authority per se institutionally because of my worldview. So I see everything as an institution. So every institution is an institution, you know, in the Foucault sense. So I feel comfortable going against it. And but it's still not easy because, of course, they push you to limits. You know, what I do is I try and I'm successful at not developing any negative emotions against my students, whatever they do. And I did tell you they have literally cursed at my face in my classroom. And that was before tenure. That's pretty challenging, you know, before tenure. Because the thing is, I have strong empathy with everyone. So I think the easiest way to get to shed, I should say, the power bestowed on us as the authority in the classroom is to empathize. Empathy is a solution to many things. Just putting yourself in those shoes, and we were there. So we've had a longer educational experience in the institutional system, even if we're teaching in grade school, you know, or kindergarten, wherever you are. You have been in an education institution to some degree, more so than the people you're dealing with, the, you know, young people or adults. It doesn't really matter. And with adults, it's even more important because they're dealing with so many other problems outside of the classroom. So not making assumptions about students appearing in the classroom because they are knowledgeable. They are more knowledgeable than we are in some respects. And we should not be insulting them by assuming that they don't know what we know. They might know more. I mean, that is why even when I share my memories, I always start with, you know, I cannot claim to have suffered a lot because I know some of you, if not all, have suffered in different ways a lot as well. This is a human reality. Every learner brings their own identity into the classroom. Whereas when you're sitting in a hierarchical position, authority position as an instructor in a classroom, if you see them all as inferior beings without knowledge, or those who don't know as much as you do, they're ignorant, and they're just students. No, they're not. Nobody's just a student, even if they are very young. And of course, in higher education, we're luckier because we're dealing with adults mostly. Nobody is just a student. Being a student is a choice, limited to a moment in life and a location in life. It doesn't define a person. So who are you, a student? No, nobody answers that question unless you're walking in the hallway or something. So I think getting rid of that authority, that sense of power, disempowering oneself as such, is empathy. Remembering that they're people, hello, with full lives beyond that hour and a half or 2 hours, 3 hours they spend with us. So this is a human setting. Three, this is a common learning environment where the teachers are going to be learning as well. And as, again, Jacques Brassier has put, you can be ignorant and still teach if you ask the right questions. You will keep learning and teaching. So teaching is actually a different form of learning. We have chosen this career to continue learning. If anyone has chosen it for other reasons, well, they're usually mistaken. And finally, nothing in our society globally is really fair. So when those people whom we call students walk into our classrooms looking for answers, ask to who have questions, if they don't have questions, we should invoke those questions in any case, are actually have not been treated fairly in the world. They are not going to be treated fairly back out there as well. So pretending to be fair to them is not a simple task. In education, institutionally, the fairness is created by giving the same exam at the same time to everybody on the same day, blah, blah, blah. That's nonsense. That is total BS, as I use the word in my classes as well. It is BS. Life is not fair. You cannot be fair by doing this. I know students in my previous experience who never wanted to take an exam at a later hour because they would be too hungry to do so, because they cannot eat when they're not home because they don't have the money. So how are you being fair, treating everyone equally? So, of course, that brings us to what social justice means, what the definitions of equity and inequality is, etc., which I'm not going to get into the abstractness of it, but I'm going to say we cannot shed our power as the authority figure unless we walk into the classroom with this mindfulness. This is not a fair world. I walk into the classroom with a full stomach in a safe place. If I'm teaching online, if I'm walking into the classroom, similarly, you know, I come from a different, you know, I didn't have to take the public commute. I would drive my electric car or something. So nothing is fair in this world. So what we're, the fairness we can create in the classroom is only by giving up. That is the beginning. By giving up our authority and empowering them so that they can have the energy, the emotional strength, and the intellectual productivity to fight the unfairness out there, which is much bigger than any grade we can give by mistake and mistaken grade. So, and when you stand there, it becomes very easy. It is not that difficult. Students may go berserk. They may step out of line. What does that mean? Step out of line means, in my world, being destructive to the learning community. If they're not destructive, I let anything happen. And I give credit for that, encouraging it. I have a GOAT award at the end of each semester, Greatest of All Times award. The students nominate a fellow student as the GOAT. And that usually turns out to be the person who earned the most extra credit points for creating a peaceful learning community, effective learning community in class. And in one of my classes, I boast with this, a student with a political view about language and everything, because when we talk about language, we talk about the social reflex of that, you know, how it, you know, racism, sexism, et cetera, interferes with language in the job market, here and there, et cetera. We discuss all these as side issues. So there was a student with a different view than the majority, let's put it that way, and who was attacked by their classmates. And in a discussion board, of course, I keep control of those things, the discourse there. And by the end of the semester, that student was nominated and voted unanimously as the GOAT. So that is the reward for me no Nobel Prize can give. So my students embraced each other with diverse political views, because that student was advocating for their fellow students. You know, when I overlooked an extra credit, they actually stood up for one of the major students who attacked them and said, Dr. Ayer, you haven't given their extra credit, you forgot to. So this is when you give them the power to do so. They sometimes, I don't want to use that term, but get organized against me in changing my opinion on something. And I salute that. I love that. And they, you know, they have the freedom to make comments about my personal life as far as I share it. That makes it easier to get rid of my authority. One of my cats, Boba, likes to go out, and I don't let him out, especially if he has a GPS tracker, so he's safe in the yard, etc. But I don't let him out when I'm teaching, obviously, because I can't run after him. So, you know, one day I shared the fact that Boba was meowing, and I said, oh, he's objecting to me because he wants to go out. You know, and I'm continuing the process of the class, and in the next 3-4 minutes, the class in the chat box have started a hashtag free Boba movement on not only my chat box, but on Twitter. But it's raining, you know, I shouldn't be letting them. One of them designed a raincoat. They came up with a charter to defend Boba's rights. How can I not love that? And then I let him. So every time I ask them whatever they wanted me to do. So this is democracy in practice too. So getting rid of our power says a lot about the democracy we're hoping to live in, because the rhetoric around democracy and the reality clash, obviously. And, you know, elected ones have power, and then they don't always, you know, work for our benefit, etc. So in that sense, the classroom is a practice in democracy. If that is what we want in our life, these are the new generations who will be taking care of us and representing us and leading us. So if for nothing else, for our own self-interest as a generation of teachers and instructors, I think we should set them free so they become the agents of our wills as representatives and create a better world than we are leaving them at the moment.
That was Dr. Gulsat Aygin. Again, that was part one of our conversation. We will be bringing you the next part on the next episode of Teacher's Lounge. As always, thank you so much for listening, and please feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests. Please do send them to teacherslounge@niu.edu and continue sending your story ideas so we can keep bringing you the best education coverage possible. Wherever you're hearing the podcast, please do subscribe, leave us a rating, or share it. If you like what we do, it really is the best way to get even more perspectives on the show. You can subscribe to the Teacher's Lounge newsletter to keep up to date with everything going on with the show. You can find a link to do that on this episode's webpage over at wnij.org. A big thank you to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear each and every episode of our show. I've been your host, Peter Medlin, and we'll be back with part two of this conversation next time here on Teacher's Lounge. We'll see you soon.